Thank you so much. I would like really to thank, first of all, for inviting me. It's really, really a pleasure to be here. I had 2 days really of incredible discussions, of very, very stimulating discussions, and such a generosity of all of you to show me the data, to share them with me, to have ideas, to have stimulating discussions. And really, I've been trained here for a couple of years ago. I was here at the School of Public Health. I made my Master of Science in Epidemiology here. And really, the U.S., I owe so much to the U.S. Germany is a good country, but we're still developing some of the research, and particularly also in pediatrics. And really, my career wouldn't have been possible without the education I received in the U.S. and without the continuing support that I received through the colleagues here and in Tucson and in Arizona. And I really, really want to thank for that continued support, and it's a great honor, and it's an even greater pleasure to be here and to share some of the data we have generated in Germany with you. So the first thing I would like to start is really just to give you a global idea of the asthma epidemiology. This is the ISAC, the International Study of Asthma and Allergies in Childhood, Phase 1 worldwide. And what you can see here is basically what is shown is the prevalence of any of three symptoms. This is either wheeze or allergic rhinitis or atopic eczema. And it's shown in quartiles. So this is the highest quartile with the highest prevalence. And this is the lowest quartile with the lowest prevalence. So very descriptive graph. And what you can see is that they are sort of, if you just focus on Europe, basically maybe from my perspective, you can see that there is a high variability of the disease of this atopic phenotype of the combinations of any of these three, with the highest prevalence hotspots in the UK and very low prevalence in Albania. And interestingly, from my perspective, is that we have as much variability within Europe as we have around the world. So we have some very, very low prevalences, for example, here in rural China, but they match the low prevalence in Albania, for example, and very high prevalences also here in the US in those centers that participated in the International Study of Asthma and Allergies. So the question is, how are these connected? What is wheezing? How is wheezing connected to allergy? It's one of the many questions you may want to ask. And there is a second phase of the ISAC where, in fact, there were not so many centers, but still a large number of centers involved, and where they also performed not only comprehensive questionnaires with these children and parents, but they also did some objective measures of atopy, namely skin prick test. And what is shown here is the odds ratio, meaning the strengths of association between skin test reactivity, meaning atopic sensitization to a number of inhaled allergens, and those symptoms of wheeze. And you can see that for what we have called here affluent countries, usually the odds ratio is around something like fourfold risk of wheezing if this child is also have allergic sensitization to these allergens. And interestingly, the strength of the association is much less in the so-called non-affluent countries. And we have grouped affluence by GNI, gross national income, which is an information on a country level, which was provided by the World Bank. And in fact, it's even more interesting. If you just show a graph where you put the gross national income here on this axis, and you show the prevalence of the current wheeze, which is attributable to the skin prick test reactivity, then you see quite a pretty strong association between the two, meaning that the more affluent the country is, the stronger is that link between atopic sensitization and the occurrence of wheeze. This is on a country level, and this is just as a sort of a descriptive analysis. And if we go now on the individual level, I think one of the best descriptions of the time course of wheeze and asthma has been done by the British cohort. This is the 1958 cohort, where they followed all the children born in that year up to adulthood. And this is just a graph showing up to the age of 33. So basically, at the age of 7 years, about 50% of the children had any type of wheeze. And from that age on, some of these children, and quite a substantial proportion of these children, lost their wheezing over subsequent years. And in fact, only up to the age of 33, there are only 5% of them who really have persistent disease, meaning that in each of these surveys, in the questionnaires, they said that they had wheezed in the last 12 months. There are some where there is a sort of an intermittent pattern of wheeze, And in some of those who had not wheezed at the age of 7, there's such something like adult onset of disease, adult onset of wheeze. And you can see in relation to what is happening in childhood, there is this new incidence of wheeze in adulthood, but it's relatively lower numbers than what it is in childhood. Interestingly, there's also, if you follow up a population with wheeze and asthma, this is the Melbourne study. They have followed up children from age 7 up to age 42, and they have also included objective markers, namely measurement of lung function. Here's the FE1 predicted. And they have included a control group, a group with mild wheezy bronchitis, asthma, and at the age of 7, they included more severe asthmatics. And you can see that at the age of 7, you have differences in FEV1 between the groups. And the interesting thing is that from there on, lung function tracks in sort of almost predetermined path as it has been set at the age of 7. This is the era before inhaled steroids were available to treat asthma in Australia. And you may wonder whether this has an effect. But in fact, if you go to the New Zealand cohort, a very similar cohort where they have studied children from birth on, and in this New England Journal paper followed up to the age of 26 for males and for females, they have had similar groups or definitions of phenotypes. And you can see a similar picture, those where there was persistent wheeze, or for the males also those where they had relapsing wheeze. There is this deficit in lung function, which is set at the age of 9, and then just basically follows and tracks into young adulthood in this case, and likewise for the women. And this is already in the so-called, in the era of inhaled steroids. So what does it do? Why is it that what we see in childhood sort of seems to determine what goes on to happen, and at least in young adulthood or even later? And I think some of the data from the mouse study give us some insight as to what might be happening. In fact, in this German birth cohort, where they have, again, followed children from birth, then up to the age of 7, up to the age of 13, they have measured lung function from age 7 up to age 13. And again, it's the same sort of picture that you see, these sort of parallel lines over those ages. But in this case, what we have done is we have stratified the non-wheezers as the control, but we have stratified the wheezers among those who are atopic and those that are non-atopic. This German birth cohort is sort of in a unique position to answer that question, because they had done blood samples at every time from age 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and they had measured specific IgE antibodies to food and inhaled allergens to these children. And so what we defined was to say atopic wheeze is those children where they had detectable IgEs to any of these, and non-atopic where we couldn't detect any specific IgE. And it's clearly among those that are the atopic ones that we see this deficit in lung function, which is sort of set at the age of 3 years, and which then tracks into adolescence. Whereas for the non-atopic wheeze, basically there is no difference to those that don't have any wheeze. So the question is, this is lung function. How does this then relate to symptoms and to the clinical manifestation of the disease? This is the same birth cohort. And so we defined the children who had wheeze at school age, meaning age 5 to 7. And within this cohort, we had sort of a retrospective look and a prospective look at the wheezing frequency among those kids who were atopic, meaning detectable serum IgEs, and non-atopic. And basically what you can see, these two curves are mostly the same one. So clinically, it's very difficult to distinguish kids between the age of 1 up to the age of 5 to 7 in terms of frequency of wheeze to distinguish the atopic and the non-atopic phenotype. The only thing is that maybe in the atopic there's a little bit more of exercise-induced wheeze, and the non-atopic a little bit more of infectious triggered wheeze exacerbations, but really these were sort of statistically significant because the number are large, but not really very strong differences in clinical significance. So what then becomes apparent is that after that age, really then the difference becomes obvious. In the non-atopic group here, these children not only retain their normal lung function. This is what I just showed you in the previous slide. But they also lose their symptoms. At the age of 13, approximately 92% of these kids are asymptomatic, whereas it is really in the group of atopic children here where this is this sort of chronic form of the disease. They have this bad lung or this decreased lung function. They have airway hyperresponsiveness. They continue with their symptoms. So we were wondering, in this group of patients, what type of sensitization gives us those apparently chronic effects, and what is the timing of these effects? And as I said before, at each of these time points, we have measures of atopic sensitization. So we could figure out what sort of sensitization pattern was resulting in this decreased lung function at school age. And basically what it is that it is sensitization occurring in the very first 3 years of life. So if at the first birthday, second birthday, or third birthday, we would be able to detect specific IgEs to perennial allergens. So this is mites, or cats, or dogs. This is the group that would be most susceptible to have this sort of chronic course of the illness. And in fact, if those children then would be exposed to the respective allergen in their environment, that's the group that show the deficit in lung function. Let me walk you through. We have a reference group here, the non-sensitized children. That's where you think all of these lung function values here at the age of school age are normal, around 100% predicted. This is the group of children who develop this early sensitization to those perennial allergens. Again, mite, cat, and dog. We only measured mite and cat allergens, so this is why it's restricted here to mites and cats. But if they're not really exposed, then low exposure means exposure below the median of the exposure in that population. We have a little bit of deficit in lung function, but it's not so much. And it's in a group where both things occur, a very early process of sensitization and then an ongoing exposure, and probably thereby an ongoing inflammation of the airways, where at school age you can see that there is the deficit in lung function which is apparent. So I think the message from the Maas study very clearly is things happen early in life, and in this data set, it really, the signal is with the first 3 years of life. Do we have any other evidence that this may be the case? And I'm showing one of the other studies which I think has really shown us and helped us to understand the natural course, which is the Tucson cohort. And basically, they followed children from birth up to the age of 16 in this particularly publication. And there's a group of children where they have persistent wheeze over the years. They didn't stratify into atopic, non-atopic wheezes as we did in the German group. But it is interesting to see that in those where they have the persistent form, which probably is the more atopic form, this deficit in lung function occurs between birth, where they had measured baby lung function in infancy, and the age of 6 years. So pretty much it seems that there's a critical period in which these things seem to happen. And there's also some more indication that it's not only allergen and allergen exposure, but there is interaction, for example, between smoking and asthma status and lung function. This is more pronounced in the girls in the study by Gilliland and colleagues from California. So what did they do? They measured smoke exposure in utero and environmental tobacco smoke exposure, and whether in these girls they had an early onset of disease or later onset, and the reference group, no asthma. And clearly, the deficits in lung function at, in this case, early adolescence, were mostly pronounced in those where they had the exposure, the early exposure, the in utero exposure, and the early onset of disease here in the first years of life, and for all of those lung function parameters which reflect airway obstruction. So this is about risk factors. But there are other things that are about protective factors. And I've been studying with a number of colleagues of mine. We have been getting more and more interested in these protective factors because we have seen that children in such an environment have a much lower prevalence of asthma at school age here, 1.4% as opposed to 12%, if in the first year of life, and it seems really to the same thing has to happen early, if they're exposed to these sort of environments. And there are a number of studies. I know now 17 cross-sectional studies who have shown these associations between being raised on a farm and having this reduced prevalence of allergic disease. And there's, to my knowledge, only one which has looked at the incidence. This is a large Canadian study where the definition of farming was a little bit crude, but still they could identify children who were raised on the farms, whether they had a parental history of asthma or didn't have the parental history of asthma. And you can see here that they had a much lower incidence than those that were the non-rurals and non-farming kids. And interestingly, they stratified the incidence. It was a two-year cumulative incidence into different age groups, 0 to 1 or 2 to 5 years. And you can clearly see that it is in this group where the adjusted odds ratio was really reduced to a third of the reference group, which was the one where they were non-rural and non-farming. And whereas for the 6 to 11-year-old, there was some reduction risk, but not as strong and not as apparent. I think to make myself better understood, I think I need to show you how these farms, how these environments are, because I think they're in no way comparable to what is here in the U.S. So basically, the studies that we did were in these small villages. There is no urban-rural comparison. It's all within a village. So we compare children who live in these type of houses, which are the farmhouses, to children who live on these houses, who are not farmhouses. And I'll show you why it's so easy to come identify farmhouses. Farmhouses, smaller, larger sizes, always have a part where the people live. And they always have a wooden part, or a concrete part, and then a wooden part. And this is where they keep the animals. This is the stables. And this is what I would call the barn, or the hayloft in my ongoing presentation. They would have, that's family-run businesses. These houses are given to the offspring through generations. So it's the mother, it's the father who runs the farm. And they wouldn't have too many cattle. I mean, you can see this is basically the size of the stable. The kids help. The kids play. They're with the parents when they do these things. So this is how they get their exposures. Some of these stables don't only have cattle, because most of the business is dairy farming, but some have a few pigs, basically for their own slaughtering and for making their own sausages, and kids, you know, get exposed. Or they have the calves here. This is certainly something where it's nice to play with. And then, of course, the milk is, that's their own product. That's what they consume. In my place of the world, people don't go to a supermarket if they have their own milk at their hands. And that's what they consume. And always, almost always, there are some chicken around, and certainly there is some contact with these animals. And the way how the foddering is done is you have the meadows around the villages, like here. And imagine you're a boy. I mean, you would dream of sitting here with your grandfather, right? And this is how they get a lot of these exposures. And then basically what they do, they take the hay and they put it in the wooden part of the house. And this is why this is wooden, because you have to have enough air that this is not moldy. Because if it's moldy, there is a risk of fire and of burning down the whole farm. And this is what it looks like if you store it for the winter period. And you can imagine, again, as a kid, how much you love to be in there. The other way to conserve the fodder for the animals is a sort of a fermentation process. This is silage. Basically, what you do, you take either the grass or you take leaves from corn, and you flatten them by taking the tractor and going above this. And then you basically close it up so that no air is going to be able to get there. And sometimes you put bacteria and enzymes into it to really sort of start the fermentation process. And this is from there where you take the silage in the wintertime, and this is how you feed the cattle in the wintertime. And this is just to show you the kitchen and anything else in the house is as normal as in any other place. They have internet, they have microwave, they have anything you would like them to have. It's just that they have this proximity of the stable and the animals. So if we look at those exposures and the farm characteristics, we can identify a number of these farm characteristics as being particularly protective. These are odds ratios. the line of unity, no effect, anything that's here is protective, anything that's here is a risk factor. And you can see, for example, here, if there is silage on that farm, then there is a protection for asthma. If there are a few pigs in addition to the cattle, or if the family has also its agriculture, but agriculture here probably means that they grow their own fodder for the animals. It's always in addition to having these cattle and the animals in the stable. Or if the child is exposed to the animal shed, or it's helping with the haying, as I showed you before, or consuming the farm milk. These are the factors that seem to protect in these farming environments. And these are a little bit different from atopic sensitization. For example, here, the effect of having poultry has been seen in a number of studies of being protective. But remember, the timing is of importance. And so we already see effect, protective effects if the mother is exposed. So the beginning of the story is really that the mother works in the stable. As I said, it's family-run business. She has to work there. These people don't make a lot of money. It's a hard job. And so she has to do it if she's pregnant, also if she's pregnant. And this is in a Parseval study where we had 8,000 children involved by questionnaire and more than 2,000 for specific IgE measurements. And this is the odds ratio relating the stable exposure of the mother during her pregnancy to atopic sensitization, meaning specific IgE in the serum in her offspring at school age. So if the mother is in the stable, the risk of atopy in the kid at school age is about half, significantly reduced. For the respiratory allergies, which is hay fever or asthma diagnosis, it seems that there is a little bit of effect. It's not statistically significant, and it seems as if the postnatal exposure, at least is as important as the prenatal exposure. We think that a lot of these effects might be explained by exposure to bacteria, to microbes, and we know that there are gram-positive bacteria, there are gram-negative ones, and that the cell wall is different for the positive ones and the negative ones. For the gram-negative, we have lipopolysaccharide, which is then also endotoxin. For the gram-positive, we have more peptidoglycan, just because the wall is thicker and is in a different is made up of more of these components. And we believe that these bacterial components are recognized by toll-like, or we hypothesize that they are recognized by toll-like receptors. Some of these receptors sit on the outside of the membrane of immune response cells, and probably you all know this. Toll-like receptor 2 recognizes a number of bacterial compounds, such as lipoproteins, but also peptidoglycan. TLR4 recognizes LPS and endotoxin, and a number of others recognize flagellin and other compounds, and there are a number of intracellular, which basically recognize DNA and RNA of these bacteria. And there are there's one more molecule that is probably interesting. It's CD14. CD14 helps to mediate the response to a variety of bacterial components, here shown for LPS. LPS binds to LPS binding protein, and then this complex binds to CD14, and then through MDE2 binds to TLR4, and then allows the signal transduction of that receptor. And now we come back to this. This is a very schematic description of how we think that might happen, and I'm not going to go into details, just to show you that what we think is happening is that we have an antigen-presenting cell, a dendritic cell. On its surface, we do have these receptors, which sometimes with the help or maybe not the help of CD14 recognize those microbial compounds, just as an example here, peptidoglycan, and then stimulate the T cells. And the T cells, depending on the signals that I receive, will then either develop in a Th2-prone, allergy-prone way, or maybe more developing in a T regulatory cell component or Th1. Why am I showing you all this? Because we try to incorporate measures of these biological phenomena into these exposure, these epidemiological studies. So again, going back to the maternal exposure, I showed you that this is relevant as a protective factor for the sensitization in the offspring. And not only is it inversely related to atopic sensitization, if the mother is exposed in her pregnancy in the stable in her offspring, at school age, there is an upregulation of gene expression of these receptors which recognize those microbes, TLR2, TLR4, and CD14. And not only is there an upregulation in a sort of a dichotomous way, but there's also sort of a dose-response relation. So this is a number of different farm animal species. The mother had contact during pregnancy, so 6 means she has seen cows and pigs and poultry and goats and sheep and horses. And the more of these different species she has seen, the more in her offspring at school age, the more TLR2, TLR4, and CD14 is upregulated. You could make a case that this is an outlier and that we should remove that. In fact, it's true. But if we remove that, basically, the relation, the association is unchanged. What I've shown you so far are cross-sectional studies where I've been looking retrospectively, asking the mother what she had done during the pregnancy and trying to do these things in retrospect way. Now we have set up a prospective study, a birth cohort, in those rural areas where we have recruited over 1,100 pregnant women, farming and non-farming, in rural areas of 5 countries. We have very comprehensive questionnaire interview information during pregnancy, and then we took cord blood of these kids through the midwife, and we stimulated them with PHA and Yonomycin, and then we measured the cytokines in the supernatants in one central lab in Marburg. Basically, IL-5 and IL-12 were almost non-detectable in those supernatants, so basically the analysis could be done for TNF-alpha and interferon gamma. The strongest effects that we see in the context of farm exposures are with TNF-alpha and with interferon gamma, both of them. And again, this is odds ratios showing an increase in the cytokine production if the mother, during her pregnancy, consumed that milk that they produced themselves. And this is shown as per liter consumption that she has per week, whether the mother was exposed to those animal sheds, whether she was exposed in these barns. And this is again shown per hour of stay in those places. And again, the same thing that we had seen sort of retrospectively in a cross-sectional study, we could reproduce in a prospective way, namely that if the mother has contact to a number of different farm animal species in the cord blood of her neonate, there would be an increased production of these cytokines. We do not know at this stage what these cytokines mean because we haven't followed up these children up to an age where we can with certainty say they are asthmatic or non-asthmatics, but this is what we want to do in the coming years. And we also have seen that there's already some IgE production in the cord blood. And one of these IgEs, which is to grass pollen, and we used a very low cutoff of 0.2 kilounits per liter, that there is a certain prevalence here of 6% here if the mother has no exposure to the animal sheds. But if she is exposed to both a source of allergen, namely the hay, and she's exposed to that context where the hay is used or handled, namely the animal shed, then this prevalence here in the offspring of IgE is pretty reduced. So what is it? I mean, it's nice to talk about silage, but I think we would all like to know what it really at the end means and what the microbes might be that confer that protective effect. The first thing we did is we measured endotoxin because basically the assay was available and because it captures all the gram-negatives in the environment. So measured the endotoxin load, that's what we call endotoxin units per square meter of the mattress where the child sleeps. And we could see that there was this inverse relation between the prevalence of hay fever, atopic sensitization, and the endotoxin amount in the mattress. Interestingly, this inverse relation is only seen for the atopic phenotype, whereas for the asthma and wheeze, which is non-atopic, it, at low concentrations, there is not much of an effect, but at higher concentrations, or higher amounts, I should say, there is this risk for an increasing risk of wheeze. So it's probably not really what we are looking for. So we turn to gram-positives. Muramic acid is part of peptidoglycan, again, part of is more reflected by exposure to gram-positives. And we divided the children up in those tertiles of exposure. Those are those that have the highest tertile of exposure, the lowest tertile of exposure. And this is the prevalence of wheeze in the last 12 months. And you can clearly see this inverse relation between the exposure and the wheeze. And in this case, it seems to be more related to the wheezing phenotype because it's more pronounced in those that are not sensitized. So maybe, yes, there is another component which may be more relating to the wheeze than to the atopy. So maybe we have found something. But there's other things that you might want to measure. And one of the things is also fungi. And for fungi, there is an assay available, which is extracellular polysaccharide, which is from Penicillium and Aspergillus, that you can measure in these environments and the mattresses again. And here, there is some indication that there might be some protection from asthma and wheeze. But the disappointing thing with all these measures of microbial exposure is that if we all put them into one model, they do not explain us the farming effect. Whereas if we put the silage and the milk and the stable and the barns, they do explain us the farming effect. So I think we're still missing the relevant exposure. So we have turned to something, to a new method where we are trying, and this is preliminary data that I show you. This is 16S RNA. So basically what you do, you extract DNA from the mattress or from the dust, and then you sort of separate the DNA strands, and then you run these, then you can copy the RNA, and you run this on a gel. And depending on the length of your fragment, these fragments run certain lengths of the gel. And then you can visualize this in a computer program that gives you sort of two bands, one band here, and then you summarize these bands, and calculate various groups. In this case, the non-farming people are children and the farming children. And the blue lines, so that gives you these bands, visualizes, and the height of the band reflects the density of the bands in the gel, basically. And what is given here is the p-values of the association between these bands and the exposure, namely, in this case, farming or non-farming. So we do see a lot of signals. Right, a lot of signals, that's a little bit reassuring because that's what you would expect. Farm children have a lot of different exposures than non-farm children. But it's not really what we want to know, right? We want to know whether there's a difference between asthmatic and non-asthmatic children. And in this case, what you would like to see is that non-asthmatic children have exposures that the asthmatic children do not have. Because in this context, we're interested in protective exposures, right? So, for example, here, in the non-asthmatic children, they have more of this exposure here, and you can see the significant p-value associated with this, and the strongest signals, in fact, here, where we have very strong signals, probably because among the non-asthmatics, this exposure is pretty frequent as compared to the asthmatics. And then we have a number of other signals here across those things, but it's a little bit reassuring that these are not so many signals than among those of the farm and non-farm. And you can do the same thing for atopic sensitization. This is using a cut point of 3.5 kilounits per liter. And we do see a different picture. To just go back, there are different signals that we can identify. At that stage, we do not know what these microbes are. The next step that we have to do is we need to go back to the gels. We can cut out those bands, and then we can clone them and sequence them, and then we can identify them. And then by identifying these microbes, we can do quantitative PCRs and run them in all the samples that we have available, which is approximately 500 samples. And hopefully, we can then confirm that really what we've seen here is the protective microbial exposure that we hope to see. So this is very preliminary data. But it may be sort of reassuring that there might be something. The other thing, of course, that we need to be careful about is that if we have a microbial exposure, it could just simply reflect the source of the exposure, namely the stable. And so we are trying to see whether this is just an intermediate step in the pathway or whether they have independent and strong association. And some of the bands do have, and these are the ones that we will cut out and clone as the first ones, and some where we feel that they have very strong effect and are independent of these other, confounding is not the right word, but of the more comprehensive exposures that we have assessed through the questionnaires. So is there anything but environmental exposures? What do we have forgotten about the genes? What role do they play? So what we have done so far is we have looked at genotyping, or together with Fernando Martinez in Tucson, Arizona, we have genotyped the number of these genes coding for the receptors for those microbes that I showed you before. And so this is a known polymorphism in the TLR4 gene, which had been published by Schwartz and colleagues. And basically, if you have a at this position, a homozygous at this very position in the gene, you are not protected from the environment. And in this case, the environmental exposure was defined as the ligand to the receptor, namely endotoxin. In this case, we defined high as above medium levels of exposure. And you can see, even if you have these sort of high exposures, if you have the wrong genetic background, meaning at this position of the gene, you are homozygous for A, you don't have the protective effect, whereas if you have the G, either heterozygous or homozygous, you are protected. And so we studied a number of these genes together with a group in Arizona. And for TLR2, we did see a similar gene-by-environment interaction, pretty strong, for the exposure being raised on a farm, and the outcome, again, the same sort of things, asthma and atopy and current high fever symptoms. And the effect for TLR2 seemed to be for both the asthma outcome and for atopic sensitization. Again, if you happen to have the wrong genes here, even if you're raised on a farm, you would not be protected. We've talked a lot about farm animals, about stables, about barns, but there's another interesting exposure, which is the milk. And this milk, which is consumed by the children, and we have seen effects in the OLEX. OLEX is the cross-sectional study in three countries. It's Switzerland, it's Germany, and it's Austria. Parseval is these is 800 children. This is 1,000 children in five countries. But basically, we do very, very similar. We do see very, very similar effects. Half the risk for asthma, a little bit less than half in Parseval, for wheeze, for hay fever, and for atopic sensitization. This is adjusted for a number of confounders. And also here, we do have a gene-by-environment interaction, which may add a little bit of biological credibility to those sort of epi findings. And this is with the CD14 gene. If you have a polymorphism here, the CD14 gene, and this formula consumption happens in the first year of life, if you have the AA genotype, you have a much reduced prevalence of asthma, 0.14 here, and this is combining OLEX and Parseval, but it's very consistent. It's seen in OLEX, it's seen in Parseval, and Parseval, where we have sufficient numbers in the different countries to do this, we see this in every of these populations. So very consistent gene-by-environment interaction, and it's here seen for asthma, wheeze, not so strong, and just a trend towards statistical significance, but clearly for hay fever and for specific IgE to pollen in these both groups. Of course, there's not only extracellular receptors, there are intracellular ones, and again, with the Tucson group, we also studied the NODs, which are here intracellularly recognizing parts or compounds of gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria. And again, gene-environment interactions with NOD1 in this case, with the allergic phenotype. If you're a farm child, this is the interaction between being a farm child and having this genetic background, again, suggesting that there's an interplay between genes and the environment. I think the interesting thing about NOD1 is that this has been first studied in a different context. It's a determinant of Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And so we were wondering, together with colleagues in the occupational department, whether being brought up on a farm would also confer some protective effect for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And Katja Raden, actually it has been published now in Pediatrics, has done a large case control study across all the pediatric gastroenterology units in university hospital children's hospitals in Germany. And in fact, she could see that having this farm animal contact in the first year of life after adjusting for a number of cofactors, this also seems to be also a protective factor, not only for asthma allergies, but also for Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. This is the first study, to my knowledge, who has looked at this. In cross-sectional studies, it's very difficult because the prevalence of these inflammatory bowel diseases is low and you don't have usually the power to look at this. So you have to do, I guess, case-control studies. So we wanted not only to do these epidemiological studies, but maybe understand a little bit better what's happening. And the only way probably we can do this in some way is to go into experimental studies. And so we use the conventional mouse model for the over-sensitization and allergic asthma. And basically what we did is we went to the stables. In all these three countries, we sampled 2 kilograms of dust. And we extracted those. So with different ways of extraction, either with water or saline or a blind dye, which is a combination of methanol chloroform, because these extraction methods are known from a biochemical endpoint that they extract different components of these things. And so we were interested, as a proof of concept, whether if we would give these extracts by inhalation to these mice, we could sort of reverse the airway hyperresponsiveness, which is induced by the overchallenge in these mice. And in fact, what we have done here is this is the control group. So you give them PBS instead of the dust extracts, and you can see an increase in airway hyperresponsiveness in these mice. And then you have the non-sensitized animals where they would be your negative controls. And in fact, if you give these extract, and this is the saline extract, it works really best for the saline extract, you can more or less completely abolish this development of airway hyperresponsiveness after overchallenge in these mice. So it's a sort of a proof of concept that in those extracts we do have substances which really give us the effect. We have been starting to look at different microbes, trying to see whether we see defects in these animal models. And we have been looking at two of them. One is Lactococcus lactis, and another one is Acinetobacter fluffy, because we have seen that they are abundant in these stable environments and that they're trafficked to the mattresses of these children. Again, we can see this reversal of airway hyperresponsiveness. And also what we can see is that in the over model here, you get this this inflammation of the airways, and that can be pretty much resolved by both of these germs. So I think this is where we are at. This is so far as we could go. We hope that we will be able to elucidate really what are the protective factors. And if I were to wrap up this presentation, I would just make a few points and say that on a global scale, the increasing affluence, which is the Isaac study, and I think it's still interesting, strengthens the link, the association between asthma and allergy. And I think this is maybe an explanation why in some of the non-westernized countries, wheeze is usually not as severe, not as chronic. This appears earlier than in our places where it's a chronic, sometimes fatal disease. To me, being a pediatrician and also from what I've seen in the epidemiological studies, I think the timing of the environmental exposures matters and may be particularly important in the first years of life. The environmental exposures clearly interact with the subject's genetic background, and we cannot certainly not see either one in isolation. And probably distinct microbial exposures, may be bacteria, might be fungi, are likely to confer protection from the development of childhood asthma and allergies. And whether this is true for inflammatory bowel disease, I think needs to be seen. So I thank you for your attention.